This program is made possible by a grant to Utah Humanities as part of the Pulitzer Prize Centennial Campfires Initiative, a joint venture of the Pulitzer Prize Board and the Federation of State Humanities Council in celebration of the 2016 Centennial of the Prizes. This year-long project in Utah is a collaboration between Utah Humanities, the Salt Lake Tribune, Utah Public Radio, and KCPW.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. And coming into part two of our conversation with John Luther Adams here was John Luther Adams' piece, portion of his piece, Light That Fills the World, performed there by New Music Detroit. By the way, you can experience some of the music that we are featuring on the program today in a very interesting presentation that John Luther Adams gave to the Banff Center, titled Music in the Anthropocene. And you can find that and much else at John Luther Adams' website, which is johnlutheradams.net. That's johnlutheradams.net. John Luther Adams is a composer whose life and work are deeply rooted in the natural world. He was awarded the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Music for his symphonic work Become Ocean, and Inuksuit, his outdoor work for up to 99 percussionists, is regularly performed all over the world. His books include Winter Music, Composing the North, and The Place Where You Go to Listen, In Search of an Ecology of Music. I believe John Cage was an influence, and you quote him, this just goes to basics, music is sounds heard, and harmony is sounds heard together.
Yeah, it's pretty elegant.
Yeah. Tell me about Cage. What influence do you think he had on you?
Well, we could do a whole conversation about that, and we'd just be getting started. There are so many ways in which Cage's influence is present, not only in my work, in my music, in my musical thinking, but in that of so many other musicians, so many other composers, and really people working in all the other artistic disciplines. Cage was kind of as Lou Harrison, or maybe Cage himself, said about Henry Cowell earlier, he was an open sesame for the rest of it. He just said opened up our whole idea of what music can be, and how we might make music and hear music and music's place in the world. I could go on in very specific ways about this or that sound or compositional technique or idea that I got from Cage, but every time I think, well, okay, now I've got it, I'm sort of over Cage, then I discover some other implication in his work that I hadn't yet realized. He's such a pervasive influence. In a way, I don't often point to. If somebody asks me who are my greatest influences, I might not name John Cage, but you know, there he is, and you can't get away from him. Mm-hmm. Nor would I want to.
Yeah. What are there other influences you would name?
I would say Morton Feldman, who of course was profoundly influenced by Cage, who was a younger friend and colleague of Cage. I would say, I'm just free associating here, Claude Debussy, or going back, let's go back 600 years, Johannes Ockeghem, the great Flemish composer of extraordinary polyphony. But I would also cite as a primary influence, the birds of North America and the landscapes of Alaska and the American West.
Yeah, that's it's a wonderful influence. I want to talk about the intersection of politics and art. I guess I've seen you say that art stands alone. How does politics enter in any way, shape, or form? We're talking mostly about environmental politics.
Well, inescapably. And yet, art, I still believe in that old-fashioned notion of art for art's sake. I believe in the intrinsic value of art as the embodiment of creative thought and as a phenomenon that makes us more fully human. And I hope at the same time more fully a part of the larger than human world. I believe that art must be useless and useful at the same time. What I mean is that if I set out to make a political statement or really even a personal statement in music, then oftentimes the results fall short as both music and as statement. Political art too often fails as art and as politics. And if the music stands on its own, then it means something. Then it's useful. And then people are open to considering, pondering the deeper implications of the music. If you're touched by something, if you're moved by something, if you're provoked by something, then you start thinking about it. If I write a lousy piece and a brilliant, give it a wonderfully poetic title and write a brilliant program note and give you a great interview about the piece, it still means nothing. All those words mean nothing if the music doesn't work as music.
Could you tell me a bit about Become Ocean? This is a newer piece, influenced, I think, by your newer surroundings.
Although it again has roots in Alaska. The newer surroundings that you're alluding to is along the Pacific coast of Mexico, where my wife and I now spend about half of our time. And my joke is that our house down in Mexico, if you have a good arm, you can stand on the patio and throw a baseball into the Pacific Ocean. Mm. It's that close. So my joke is that all I did to compose Become Ocean was to sleep with the windows open at night and then get up in the morning and write down the music that I'd heard in my dreams.
Just that simple, I guess, yeah.
Yeah. And it must have been in some way, because the piece came within kind of a tsunami of composing within 4 months. But it had deeper roots. It grew out of a shorter piece called Dark Waves that I had composed several years before for the Anchorage Symphony. And I spent a full year working on that 12-minute piece, so that then a couple of years later I spent only 4 months writing a 42-minute piece.
There's an interesting piece, and by the way, you can find a lot of these at the website johnlutheradams.net. Soundwalk. You're
uh-huh.
You're taking sounds from downtown New York City. And so tell me, what are you going for with Soundwalk?
Yeah, I love making New York jokes at the expense of my fellow Westerners. These sounds are not from downtown; they're from Midtown.
Oh, but okay, yeah. I've displayed my ignorance here. Yes.
No, I'm laughing about it all. But you know, it is true that we have this idea. I'm just starting to get my ears on in New York. I still am overwhelmed by the soundscape here and haven't learned to hear clearly yet. But I am amazed as I learn to listen to this noisy place. I've come to hear that every neighborhood, every part of town, has its own unique sound print. Its own voice, if you will, and I'm surprised to discover that, you know, my Alaskan idea, oh, New York, it's just this big undifferentiated roar that never ends. That's just wrongheaded. In fact, I'm amazed that even around the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where these sounds are gathered for the Soundwalk, you can hear much farther than you might imagine. And you can hear small sounds like rustling leaves or chipping birds or a little gust of steam coming out of a grate in the sidewalk or little bits of quiet conversation from across the street or over in the park. This piece, Soundwalk 909, was a commission for the opening of the new contemporary wing of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The Whitney Museum of American Art moved downtown last year to a new building. And the Met, or a couple of years ago, and the Met has moved into annexed the former Whitney, which is the Breuer Building on Madison Avenue, and it's this brutalist hulk, but it's a kind of iconic it's a landmark. And so the Met invited me to create a piece that would connect the two Mets, if you will, the big Met, the main Metropolitan Museum of Art on Fifth Avenue, and then the new Met Breuer, eight blocks down and one avenue over. And so I got the idea of crowdsourcing the sounds. And we invited, we had an open season for recordists to go out into the streets, into that grid of streets between the two buildings and gather sounds. And then I used those sounds as the raw material from which I made this piece. It's actually two pieces. There's a downtown and an uptown version. That is for walking downtown or for walking back uptown.
And you say in a note to the listener, these pieces are not complete until you're present, listening, walking your own route, etc. And you go on to say the ideal listening balance between live and recorded sounds is one in which you aren't always certain whether the sound you're hearing is coming from your earbuds, your imagination, or the streets around you.
Yes. And when that happens, it's really magical. I've experienced that and been on a couple of walks with people who have experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea how the pieces work on their own, but... you know, I like listening to them on their own. I think they are most complete when they're in that site, when you're listening on those streets. But I think they stand on their own.
Thank you.
Place is a powerful influence. When we say place here in Utah, we're often talking about Red Rock, deserts and the powerful influence they have. That brought to mind, I just wanted to follow up. So you were in Alaska for many years, and I can understand going from Alaska, maybe easier for my imagination to go from Alaska to, Mexican Pacific coast, but Alaska to, sure. New York City, that's a bigger jump. Were there specific reasons for that, or just what you want to do with your career, or what?
No, I've always loved New York. I don't like cities, but if I'm going to be in a city, I want to be in the city. And for me, New York is the city. And again, it's a little bit like the soundscape. I've discovered over the years that, unlike our stereotypical image of New York as this big urban sprawl, it's a kind of collection of little villages all stuck together. Our neighborhood here in South Harlem is just extraordinary, and it's this convergence of languages and cultures and people from all over the world that is really vibrant and exciting. It's like being in a kind of oasis in the desert, where you hear all these birds all around you. And all this wonderful food and all this music. And another thing about New York that makes sense coming from Alaska is that New York City is one of those singular places, right? There is really no other place like New York City. That's true of every place. But after 40 years in Alaska, where do you, especially Fairbanks, which is extremely Alaska, as we like to say, after 20 years in Fairbanks, where do you go? I couldn't settle in some nice, comfortable suburban surroundings. And, it just makes a certain amount of sense. And we have, I couldn't live here full time. But we have, to balance us, we have, our life down in the desert. And it's, so far, it's working really well. Talk to me in another year or two, and we'll see how it's going.
Right. Yeah. Well, it does sound like a good balance. Finally, what sorts of things are you working on now? You mentioned string quartets?
Yeah. I never thought I'd write a string quartet. And then at the age of 59, my best friend dies without asking my permission. And I was moved to write a little piece for solo violin because he, Gordon Wright, was a violinist, among many other things, composer and conductor. And that turned into a string quartet, and one string quartet led to another string quartet. I have this wonderful relationship with the young quartet, the Jack Quartet, who are based here in New York City. And they performed and recorded that first quartet, The Wind in High Places, and I've since written two others, and I'm sitting here today working on a fourth. So I'm writing string quartets, something I never imagined I would do. I'm now in the editing stage of another big orchestral piece. Completes a trilogy, Become River, Become Ocean, and now Become Desert. And that will be premiered in a couple of years. It's a commission for the Seattle Symphony again, and San Diego Symphony, and the New York Philharmonic. And what else? I'm now in the editing stage of a memoir. This is actually my third book, but it's the first one that I feel like I'm really writing from scratch. It's a memoir of life and work in Alaska, 40 years in Alaska.
Well, we'll look forward to that. The music, we'll look forward to the memoir as it comes out as well. You can find out much more at the website, johnlutheradams.net. John Luther Adams, thank you so much. Been a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you to you for listening to Access Utah. We're going to go out with a bit more of the music of John Luther Adams. Here performed by Jack Quartet is a portion of The Wind in High Places Above Sunset Pass.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.